Hi, Echo.
Hi there. I don't know if I'm mic'd or not. Hang on a minute.
I can hear you.
Okay, I'm typing an email someplace else, so hang on. Okay, so where am Hi.
How are you?
I was just typing a response email to this very nice person who works for the Mid-Willamette Valley Community Action Agency in Salem regarding their experience with cooling shelters last summer. And I'll send that email to you soon so we can share it with everybody. But it was really interesting. I mean, Salem's different, obviously, than here. But he said that we didn't have anything formal or written out last year, so we just threw it together and made the most of the situation we had. They used 100-degree thresholds. They have a mobile outreach team that works with encampments because they have a really kind of different situation than we do. We don't really have quite settled encampments, at least not in Ashland. Medford's a different story. For up there, he said they were running into people because they were mostly focused on homeless folks who would not go to a shelter. So they were focused on doing delivery of water and electrolytes to people on the street. And he has one story that he said, we offered one client a ride to a cooling shelter, but because of the need to abandon his belongings to get there, he opted to stay at his camp along Interstate 5 and passed away later that weekend. So that's an important insight about, people need to have security for their stuff.
And
So
too.
he's really emphasizing having outreach. They don't have a policy and process yet, but they're working on it with their emergency services program manager. So they're starting to kind of do what we're doing, it sounds like. And so that was really. It was a really lovely email from him that I really appreciated.
Nice. They're on the statewide group that has been meeting since the beginning of the pandemic. And so I do hear from them about, different things that they have going on. And we actually had our last meeting, I don't know when it was, 2 weeks ago, was about, how are people like addressing policies around this and how are they doing? And somebody, I want to say it was them, did a PowerPoint presentation. It was interesting. Like you said, though, they have different resources than we have, and their situation is a little different. I mean, everybody's is throughout the state. Some people have lots of resources, some people have no resources. We're a little bit in between. We have some. What was I going to tell you, though? There was something in there. Oh, gosh. I'm pretty scattered today, and I don't.
Oh, well, me too. I mean, it just there's like
Oh, that's what it was.
drama going on with the painting of my entire townhouse little development, with issues with some overspray and one of my other neighbors who's upset with something else. So I've been being the customer complaint department today around that,
Oh,
which sucks.
no.
So there's that, and then I'm doing this volunteer thing with the long-term recovery group. So one of the people that I had reached out to gave me a call back. So I had to shift gears in my head from this and that other thing to go, oh, right, you're Joseph Kauth, and I'm supposed to call you back, and or you were going to call me back, and so let's set something up, and here's what we do, and here's what it's about. So he called me like 20 minutes ago while I was trying to make sure that I didn't miss anything important for this meeting. Anyway, so I've been multitasking and it's felt a little bit like what I used to do for a living. And it's making me realize, okay, I really did want to be retired.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I did find four things that we should add to the minutes from last time.
Oh, okay.
I read them.
Well, okay, great. And you know, I'm going to take notes. I don't know if Liz is going to be joining us. She has a training that goes into our meeting time. And then she's been she's actually been homesick.
Oh, gosh.
I know. So hopefully, I got to find a working pen here.
Yeah. So I can tell you what those minutes fixes are now if you want.
Oh, no, we'll wait.
Or I can wait for the meeting.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll wait and we'll do it then.
It's like
recorded. So she'll be able to get it.
Mm-hmm. And I think I copied you on the Zoom recording that I made of that meeting. So it was a huge file.
I know. I can't email them either. I have to put them somewhere on the web.
Yeah, they go. When I use my school email, at least I can send it as a Google Drive link.
Yeah, that's
so. That's what you may have gotten.
Yeah, I think that's what we had to do before too.
Yeah,
it's really hard.
When it's in like a 90-minute meeting, it's just really huge. Like I know I can't even send it as a Google Drive link if I'm using my personal email.
Yeah.
I have to use that SOU email that has more bandwidth
or whatever.
The lucky thing about being an emeritus faculty member is I still get that little advantage. So
very nice. That's a nice thing.
Yeah.
I did remember what it was. You had said that a board member from the school district had reached out to you.
Yes, Jill Franco.
And do you want to invite her to our meeting?
Well, she reached out about affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think they probably had, I know they opened up some sheltering right after the fire.
They did. Yes.
And I don't know who the point person was for that.
You know, I might be able to find out.
But that might be the most logical person, whoever that was.
Yeah. I will look. I think I might have information about that, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. But if we're talking about rent burden and affordable housing and we have some sort of community meeting around that, Jill Franco definitely would be clearly somebody who's expressed an interest.
Okay, good. Yeah. Well,
I talked her ear off as usual. I sent her the link to the capacity analysis and
wonderful
all that kind of stuff, which I just send people now because it's really very thorough.
Yeah, it's honestly people love getting stuff like that because they're looking for that information.
Yeah,
and it's compiled all in one place that makes
sense. And it's multiple viewpoints. It's not just one side.
Yeah, you know, it sounds strange, but housing data is not easy to come by. People always think it just exists in the world somehow for no reason. And odd data sets they think exist and they just don't. And it's hard to find them. And it's kind of like it shapes a narrative, you know, when you're looking at these different things. But this is a great document to have.
I mean, I've spent many years of my life trying to tease out very specific little bits of info from the current population survey and census.gov and the Bureau of Labor Statistics and all those things that sociologists do. And it's incredibly confusing. And then during the Trump administration, there were sporadic efforts to actually reduce access to data, to like cut jobs and stop publishing certain kinds of reports. And I don't know how much of an impact that had. I don't know if those cuts that did get made, if they've been restored, because control over information controls the political narrative.
That's true. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so the Trump administration was not only messing with the census, they were messing with other things too.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And so there's tons of information out there, but unless you're a subject area specialist, whether in academia or in public sector, who does this all the time, you just cannot keep all the balls in the air.
It's hard. Yeah. I wrote the housing needs analysis in 2012, the census had it was the census.gov website. No, it was American Fact Finder, which was the best, easiest to use platform. And
pretty intuitive. Yeah.
Loved it. And during the Trump administration, they did away with that.
Yeah, exactly.
But now the website for the census, I can't even figure it out. I can't navigate. Yeah. It's awful.
Yeah. I know, you get lost in a bunch of really kind of raw data files.
Yeah. And it doesn't give you the sort of ability to pull down specific data. Right.
Yeah. So unless you're an actual demographer, it can be almost impossible.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah. Hi. Oh my God. Hi.
So Heidi, you were in Maine in our last meeting. Were you on vacation there?
Yeah.
Where in Maine?
Vacation in 2 years. No, it was great. I don't even know the name of excuse me, my phone's ringing.
In progress.
Hi, Lita. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Okay. Hi, everybody.
I just saw Benny leave the room.
Benny, is that a dog or a dad?
A dog.
It's our dog.
The dog. Yeah. When Benny doesn't like to be alone. So when Lita and Steve want to go someplace, sometimes they let me come and hang out with their dog.
We're very happy that she loves our
dog. I'm on the Benny team.
He's a great dog. Except of course that he doesn't like being left alone, and when we have, he howls.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's heartbreaking. It's terrible.
I feel for you. But glad Echo can get the therapy. Dog therapy, that's the best.
Absolutely. You know, and they only live like literally 3 minutes from me. So it's not hard.
We're very thankful because we try, even now that it's a little colder, we've taken him out a couple times to eat outside in the evening.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's a total sweetheart. Oh gosh.
Rita, thank your husband for me for coming out and helping with the pallet shelter.
Oh, I always volunteer him. I physically can't do a lot, so
that's great.
Yeah.
That was really great. So Lita's husband came out when we put out that call for volunteers. And,
oh, neat.
I think he had a good time. I met him while he was out.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He likes doing stuff like that.
Nice.
So
maybe we can organize at some point some little outdoor concert at the pallet community.
Well, you know, we would love to do that.
I think that would help soften the image from the ugly fence.
Oh yeah,
I don't know what to do about the fence. It actually doesn't meet the planning requirements as it is, so I'm gonna have to get spend more money, I guess, just to get some sort of screening. It's supposed to be a screening fence, but you know, they don't own the property, so they can't put up a real fence. It has to be temporary.
Right.
Is there anything we can weave through it?
Yeah, the white slab. Or the green?
Yeah, the green. I think the green thing is what we're going to have to have.
Yeah, green is pretty.
Yeah, I think it'll look better. So because Rogue Retreat is our sub-grantee, everything runs through them. So I need to contact them. And you know, we did the planning process because obviously we have planners. So it was easier for us to do it in-house. And part of it was that screening, because that was what was required initially, was like some screening for the neighborhood, because that was like seen by the county as lessening the neighborhood impact. Anyway, so
yeah.
cool. That fun little stuff.
Well, I'm just thinking about making the word community not just an aspiration, but a reality.
Well, fingers crossed. I'll give you a brief update when we get there.
Awesome.
Before we start on the agenda, I just have one question. Because I've been thinking about the housing problem and am very, very frustrated, as I've talked to Echo about. I'm wondering whether it's ever been done or possible or whether it would help to have some kind of ad hoc committee of maybe a representative of the Housing Commission and other departments and commissions to try to figure out a way through this morass of rules and problems, you know, to find a way with the developers or some way to do this, to get affordable housing built here. I mean, I don't know. It just seems that every time we talk about it, other than the way we're currently doing it, which is actually phenomenal that we can even do that. But just to do more, you know, whether there's anything that you think could happen that way.
Well, the next thing that's moving forward, at least for my department, and I'm in the planning department, but I'll talk about that a little bit later, is the housing production strategies. So we're moving forward with that, which was part of the requirement of the housing capacity analysis, was sort of look at, you know, what some of the, how much housing you need at different price points and for different, you know, types of housing and different populations, and how much land do you have and what's its own, you know. Echo and Rich could do a better job probably because they really immerse themselves in it. And then the next section is, okay, how do we get what we need? And there are some looking at strategies that we could enact that the city has control over. And then we'll be working in it through a whole process over the course of like a year. And we will convene a meeting of another group similar to what Echo and Heidi, not Echo and Rich.
Right.
Echo and Heidi were a part of, where it's you know, going to be representation from different commissions. There'll be some planning commissioners, probably people from the equity. I can never get the name of that right.
Social equity and racial justice.
Yes. And sure. Conservation. And, you know, so that it'll be a multidisciplinary team who can kind of bring in their, whatever they're thinking. Rich, go ahead.
I just wanted to add that with your frustration that we better ask the city to speed up the timeline for it, because the strategy document that they'll approve isn't due until middle of 23, and they've got a schedule that kind of goes up to that. So if we accept that, that's when we will see it. We'll be planning it along the way, but if we want it any faster, then we'd have to figure out a way, and it isn't easy.
Gina, go ahead.
So something that, thanks for bringing that up, Rich, because we can definitely do that. All we need is myself and another counselor to get that on the look ahead, to have that discussion, and then make it fact, because I totally agree, 2023 is too far away. And Linda, I heard you mention, I'm sorry I came in a little late, but that we would be working on this for a year.
So the part that would be worked on is the identification of the strategies, and then the priority of implementation for them. So I think at the end of the housing capacity analysis, and I don't want to talk too much about this because it's not on our agenda, and I don't want to get in trouble. And we will talk about this. You know, we could probably have Brandon come to the next meeting to just give you an overview of where that process is at this point. We got a grant from the Department of Land Conservation and Development to do this process. And it is prescribed by the state of Oregon for all communities of a certain size and to go through the process, which includes public outreach. So that's the piece that we need to work in over the course of meetings. And then it has to have, of course, an ordinance adoption, which will have to go through you and then planning and then to council twice. And so really that year-long schedule is a matter of how do you get that public outreach component, draft the document, get it through three different bodies at their monthly meetings in succession, essentially. And it is not slated to, I mean, the state legislature gave an end date for this project for all communities in Oregon who have updated their housing capacity analysis of the June of 2023. But we are on a schedule to be completed by the end of December of 2022 is I think what we are looking at. And part of that is the consultant. So we are working once again with Echo Northwest, who did such a great job on our housing capacity analysis. So it works out really well. It's going to dovetail with that work that they've done already. And then they will essentially be the, you know, the ones who go through that process. And I think as Rich noted at the end of the housing capacity analysis, this was the most important piece of that work is to take these strategies and prioritize them, which then is going to line out, you know, what types of incentives and, well, anyway, I'll talk about that when we talk about the housing program that we'll enact over the course of all these next year.
Okay, well, I'll shut up and we can get back on schedule now.
Jackie?
One of the things I would love to have possibly at our next meeting or maybe at our retreat that might help with some of the frustration, because I, Lita, I feel your frustration. I have the same frustration, but to have a list of where we are on certain projects that are currently in the works so that we can feel, you know, I mean, I've been waiting for the, is it 70 units on Iowa? I mean, I've been waiting 4 years for that to break ground and it hasn't yet. And I think I've been told that it's been approved, mm-hmm. but if I had some feedback on what's going on with a project like that, it would help with some of the frustration. And then, of course, to know a little bit, refresh us on what happened with, you know, the 132 units going out with Kendrick, that kind of thing. I mean, just sort of let us, and then the 52 units off of North Mountain that has just gone through, you know, with the city council. I mean, there are things that are happening that I would really like to be refreshed on so I can have a little more positive of an attitude and still fight the fight for more affordable housing.
Okay, I'm gonna call an end to this because we're gonna call this meeting to order and start doing an actual meeting. but boy, this is a rich discussion. We should have pre-meetings more often. and we have a block of time in this meeting where we're really doing a sort of an overview of everything, because three of you are one of you is really very new, two others are relatively new, and then Kathy Colley, who's not with us tonight, is also very new, but she'll be able to track this in a recording. But anyway, we're going to do a kind of big picture of what we're about, and if you can incorporate some of this conversation, Linda, into your presentation, that would be awesome. With that, I'm glad you're here tonight. We're ready to go. We got stuff to do. are there any other guests with us, Linda? There's no public forum request. Okay. The very first thing we're going to take a look at is the rent burden discussion.
Minutes? Do we need to do the minutes?
We do need to do minutes.
Okay.
Sorry.
I found problems. Heidi was gone, so I looked at him.
All right.
okay.
Have the minutes? Thank you for sending them out again, Linda. Everybody's got them? Okay, so changes, Echo?
Yes. So there's four. First, fixing the name of Greg Perkinson, not Perkins, in the minutes stated that the next regular meeting would be October 21st. That was actually October 28th. I think we sort of mentioned the names of our new members at the September meeting. And so I think the minutes should include that we announced the approval of Kathy Kelly and Joy Fate would be joining us at the part of that September meeting. There was also, we also mentioned that all of our social service grant recommendations were approved by the City Council on whatever date that was that they approved them. And I can't remember what date that council meeting was, but that should probably go in the minutes as well. How'd I do, Heidi? Did I get it right?
Heidi, what are you?
Yeah, that's great. What I wanted to add is that I wasn't at the meeting, and it was really difficult to know what the resolution of each item was. So if there could be added, like, a link to where you see what the SOU properties that were mentioned are found. Otherwise, you read this and you have, there's just no way to do follow-up because you don't know what happened. And on the Housing Now proposal, what was the action? Was there an action or was there a discussion about what comes? It's just sort of left hanging. And maybe that's what happened. I don't know. But I wasn't there and I can't tell from the minutes. They're not quite complete enough for me to know actually what happened. So
I think that we don't necessarily have to approve them tonight. If you feel like I think we can send them back and bring them to the next meeting and see, you know, have request those changes, and then we'll just bring them with the next meeting minutes. Does that feel like it would be a better option? I mean, at this point, it feels like there's kind of a lot of changes.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, great. I'll make a note. I've made a note of all the things that you've said, and I told Echo before the meeting, so I should say it during the meeting, that Liz Hamilton, who does our minutes, was in a training today, but also is homesick. So she was in an online training. So she may be joining us at 4:30, or she may not join us at all. Either way, this is recorded, so she'll hear the feedback. I'm taking notes, and I will provide her with that feedback, and we'll both go over those, and then we'll get those out to you for the next meeting.
Great. Are there any other changes to the minutes? All right, now to the rent burden discussion.
So I have to admit that this is not much of a discussion, or I mean, I guess it could be as much of a discussion as you guys would like to make it. As it says in the memo, the state of Oregon passed a house bill in 2018 that requires all cities who have experienced more than 25% severe rent burden in their communities to have a yearly discussion about rent burden. In the past, we have done a much more in-depth discussion, inviting affordable housing providers. We've invited landlords and tenants and the Southern Oregon Alliance of, I can't remember what that housing forum, it was great, and have had, I think, really meaningful, good discussions about this. And then last year we had the pandemic and we really didn't do anything, even though it is required through this House bill that we hold a public meeting and report back on the public meeting every year in January. And also they send us the numbers of the percentages of people who experience extreme severe rent burden. So this year I contacted them to ask them, you know, what are your expectations around us, you know, holding some sort of public meeting or doing some sort of outreach event. And they essentially told me that they have no way to compel us to do these things and that there are no repercussions if we don't. So it was a little bit of a relief because they felt like, oh, at least we're not going to get in trouble if we don't like organize a huge event. But on the flip side, I felt like, you know, we do have time on the agenda. We could have this a discussion about it. I guess I feel bad because in years past, I feel like it's just been more meaningful and we put more thought into it than just putting it on the agenda. So I did want to just compile the information that they have provided to us since House Bill 4006 was passed in 2018. And I should tell you that I feel like after I compiled all the numbers, I felt like they didn't really mean that much. And they all are American Community Survey data, which some of you may or may not know, can sometimes have a large margin of error. And what I noticed is that these numbers don't seem to move that much over time. So anyway, it made me just question the value of them. Not like in a, you know, a real sense, but just in this sense. Go ahead, Heidi.
I would have thought that this year, because of the fire, that the numbers would be greatly different. And I was surprised that they're actually not.
I think we'll see it.
It also looked like the population went up, but the total renter households went down. So I don't know. Is there a way of having more explanation of what those numbers actually, you know, who's included in that and who's excluded? And does it include mobile units as well as, you know, are the campgrounds that we have, are those included? That's outside the city limits, so probably not. But what about people at shelters or assisted living? Are all those numbers included?
So I would say, and I don't know if you have an answer to Heidi's question. I guess my short answer would be that generally American Community Survey data is done by a random sampling of houses and then extrapolation. And so I would say, and it's also done in small communities like Ashland over weird periods of time. So it'll be like 1 year and then, or a 3 year running total or a 5 year running total. In fact, I think we barely ever have a 1 year. So it may not be reflective of the fire at all because we haven't reached that time period. Sorry, I just saw Joy's hand is up. I don't know whose hand was up first.
Joy's hand was up next.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Joy's hand was up next.
Go ahead, Joy.
Are we obligated to receive inaccurate data from a company? Meaning, are we obligated to keep receiving this data from a consulting firm that uses methods that don't adequately reflect our situation?
So the data actually comes from the federal government. It is census data. American Community Survey data is census data. And sadly, it is the most accurate data that we have available unless we pay a company to do it separately, individually, like an actual survey. And we actually are given these numbers from the state of Oregon. So that's where these numbers come from. It doesn't come from a consultant. And I mean, we can accept them or not accept them. I mean, it doesn't matter. I think what they're saying is, look, you have a lot of rent burdened people and you need to try to address that in some way. And so this effort is somewhat tied to the processes that we're going through now, the housing capacity analysis and the housing production strategies. So it's kind of and Rich could probably, maybe that's what you want to say, Rich. It's just a much more comprehensive look, I think, from the state, or a more comprehensive acknowledgement from the state of Oregon that many communities in the state of Oregon experience severe rent burden and have affordable housing issues, and that they want cities to be more aggressive about how they address affordable housing issues. That's my take on it. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, I just thought that because of the kind of checkiness of those data, that it really puts a premium on people giving direct testimony. And I just wanted to say that my adult son was burned out in the fire. He lived over at the Bear Creek, just on the north of Ashland. He has a disability that for him really requires living in Ashland mostly. And so he did find a rental unit after staying in a hotel, but that isn't going to last forever. And so he and his partner have been searching the want ads for rentals in Ashland. And that experience for people that have done that is really dramatically bad. So that's what you would hear if you heard renters come and say that. Now, once we know that, the question about how do we address it is, I think, the whole issue for the whole city and for us to look at. But anyway, that's what I wanted to say, is that a premium on hearing from people, I think, trumps whatever that little data thing that we got. So.
I would just like to add to that, that as I see this, like for 2021, 1,300 out of 4,200 households experience severe rent burden, which is half of their income or more going to pay rent. And all of the rental application forms want you to have 4 times or 3 times your rent and income before you will even be considered to rent, kind of defines the problem. It's big.
It is, absolutely. Chris?
So, of course, this is also a personal, you know, issue with me when I first came to Ashland as well. You know, as many of you know, I work here in the community. I've worked here at SLU and still I'm faced with that same, you know, rent burden of having to use more than half my income in order to be able to live here. So, you know, of course, this is also goes back to our main employers as well, and trying to work here and survive here. But what I was really wanting to ask is there a way to maybe, when we have these reports, maybe to have a summarization of some of the current policies that are in place, so that way we can revisit that, whether it be either a zoning issue or whatever the case might be, but just maybe kind of see what we're doing and maybe what we could be working on in the future, I think would be something important going forward. Because right now, I really don't have a lot of knowledge on what policies or ordinances we have in place at this time to like say, okay, well, we should work on this or look at that. So
that's what we're going to do today.
All right.
Hey, Gina.
So very timely. Gina.
Thanks, Linda and Linda. I had a question. Looking at this rent, most of the renter properties have a property management company. That's something that I see. Is there any way that this body could, I don't know, because of the house bill, is there any way that we could connect with these people or anything to try? And because what was brought up earlier is that you have to have double the pay to be able to rent. So even if you can scrounge together your money, if it doesn't look good on paper, then you won't be able to rent. Is there any way that you might think we can approach the property management companies?
You know, unfortunately, so that's one of the things that we'll talk about when we do the housing program overview. You know, they're just within the city's toolkit, there are limited tools, I would say, one of which is that we don't have a lot of influence in the private market. So while we'll go over the things that we are doing and the policies we do have, and then, you know, the housing production strategies is going to hopefully add more tools to our toolkit. But it is a very challenging thing to do rent regulation in almost any way. And so, like, property management companies can set any threshold they want. I mean, as long as it's not against fair housing law or, with their own private property. So, I mean, I think that, you know, is always the contention in American society is private, you know, private property versus public good. And so we theoretically are in our mission is to do things for the public good, but there are certain taboos that we are not able to enforce within the private property law, I guess I would say. But I do know that property management companies are an issue.
We should get rid of those guys. So I have a question. Lita, I wanted to ask something really quick of the body. Are you guys going to have another meeting like we used to have in the good old days? Are we going to have a Zoom meeting of any kind where we can invite the community in, or when we talk about RID burden?
I think I would really like to do that again in the future. Hopefully next year we'll be able to plan something, and maybe it'll be something like our affordable housing bus tour, and we could integrate pieces of that. But you know, that last effort we did, it took a lot of planning. It took months of planning and, you know, subcommittee meetings to sort of decide how best to address this. So I think, you know, I didn't want to give it short shrift this year, and I would hope that we could spend some time on it next year and do something much more meaningful and hopefully beneficial, maybe in conjunction with that housing capacity, housing production strategies. Lita, you had something?
I just had a question. When you were talking about rent and the management companies, does that mean that we are not able to have any rent control?
Yes. The state of Oregon does not allow rent control.
Oh, wow.
Rich probably knows more, could speak more about this, because I think he's had this. This has been something he's worked on for years.
Well, wow. the power of the rental and real estate issue, people in the legislature has completely obliterated the issue of cities being involved in rent control. They did pass a rent stabilization bill, but that was the legislature that did that, and that set a few boxes around rent hikes. But in terms of cities' power to set rents, it's zero. And it's because of the power of the real estate interests in the legislature.
So we're as a city, we can't do our own rent control.
No.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that.
I'm gonna ask that we move on, because we're going to have more discussion in this broad a stroke look at housing issues significantly in our agenda. But I want to say thank you to Echo for posting information about the census data.
I just wanted to let everybody know that I put in a couple of links. I have this stuff in my head because I used to teach it. Yeah. So if you want to nerd out, there's a couple of places to start.
Thank you. Before we dive into that overview, I want to just get us to nail down our dates for our upcoming meetings. For those of you that are new, typically we have had a planning retreat in December where we really set our priorities for the upcoming year and just spend a longer time focusing on what we're about than in just the taking care of business meetings. So our next meeting is scheduled to fall on Thanksgiving Day. I think we're all in agreement that that's not a good plan. So some of the options that Linda sent out to us is maybe combine the November and December meeting to have a longer December meeting as our retreat, or meet earlier in November and then meet again in December. What is your pleasure?
I love the retreat idea. I love for us to have a little more time to talk, to hear from, you know, some specialists about different issues. So I would be willing, if you wanted to cancel a meeting in November and then have a retreat in December, I'd be happy with that, but I'm open.
Well, I'm voting for November 19th and a retreat. I think we could use them all. And yeah. I mean, clearly we've had a retreat every year, have we not? I don't know, for some years.
Yeah.
And it's so invaluable. We can't do the work without it.
Yep.
So I think that's a given, but I don't want to give up November, just me. But anyway, that's
November 18th? Is it the 18th, Rich?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it is the 18th, yes.
Yeah, does that work for people? I mean, because that's if people, go ahead, Echo.
Yeah, I just wanted to support a November meeting too, because we're having the weather shelter meetings the week before that. And I think having a report to this group about those two meetings would be really important.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're saying having a meeting on the 18th of November, the third Thursday?
Does mm-hmm. that work for people?
That work for everybody?
Yeah. Yep. Do you want to do the same time, the 4 to 6 time?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I will schedule that meeting. And it sounds like we do have a few items. Maybe we could get Brandon to come and give us a housing, just an update of where housing developments are and sort of what the holdup is. And then also the severe weather event stuff and potentially an update about the housing. Why do I keep production strategy? I want to keep saying house. I've said housing capacity analysis for so long that that's okay. All right. And then December, we also want to have a retreat. Generally, it's a little longer. It can be 3 or 4 hours, which I know seems like a lot. It was a lot better when we had, you know, we got to do it and be all together somewhere and have coffee and snacks or lunch or something. It broke it up. And maybe we can figure out how to do that by December, if that's something that happens in the world, or I don't know, maybe we can all just make our own coffee and sit next to a fireplace or something. Does anyone have any ideas for a date that would work best?
Let me just say, we're going to be gone from the 2nd through the 19th. So
It
sounds like it's unlikely we'll be able to be at that. I won't be able to.
I will be leaving by the 19th. So
that covers it.
Okay. That's pretty much it.
Is there a possibility we could meet in person, Linda?
You know, I think we could. I'm not sure like how that would work or if there's sort of I don't think there's a limitation. I'm not sure if I can use a city building. We'll have to see how that goes too. Because right now we're sort of limiting the use or the number of people who can congregate. Gina, for you.
Gina's got a spot.
You're muted.
At Hills, I could check and see if we can be in the same room. It's pretty big. And we could mask up and kind of spread out. And
that would be awesome if we could be there, because that gives us plenty of room to socially distance.
That's wonderful.
What date?
Okay.
That's the question.
About the 9th, the 16th, one of those. 9th or the 16th of December?
16th.
Okay. All people who like the 9th, raise their hands.
I can do the 9th. I can do both.
Me too. Yeah.
Okay. How about the 16th? Is everyone? Okay. It looks like maybe Joy can't do the 16th. Well, I feel like I'm sorry. Maybe we should do it this way. Who can't come on the 9th? Except for Lita, because we already know.
Yeah, I can't.
Linda?
I'm good.
Okay. Do you guys want to do that? I mean, it sounds almost like it's 9th?
That would be great.
Okay, let's do the 9th. Then what time do you guys want to do it? Because it generally is longer. Maybe we could just do like a 3-hour meeting, which I know seems like a long time, but it really does go by fast. And do you want to maybe make it an hour earlier, or go an hour late, or like time frames? What do you guys think?
Can we stay flexible on that and see what the space allows?
Can we do that?
You know what? I think earlier would be better, just in case you guys have something booked. But
yeah.
I mean, like 11 to 2, and then we could have lunch or snacks or whatever, 11 to 2.
That'd be great.
Do people?
Yes. Thumbs up if that works.
Chris? Okay.
Thumbs up. Hi, that works for you. Okay.
Joy, does that work
for you? That work for you?
11 to 2.
Yeah. Okay. Let's book it.
All right. So I'll email Linda.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, guys. You did that.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah. You did so quickly.
And yeah, thanks for that option. And I would love to have a face-to-face meeting. That would be great. And I suspect we will need to be masked to do that. And that's if that's not a problem for anybody, then that's the would be an ideal way to actually be in the same room after 2 years. Yay!
Yay! Isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Okay. So we're good on both November and December. Heidi.
I was just going to say a lot of like the Timbers soccer team, you can go to a in-person game if you show proof of vaccination and wear a mask and then socially distance and take your mask off only if you're eating. But that was, it was also a sheltered outside area. But if we, if all of us were vaccinated and we knew that, or we knew who wasn't vaccinated, we could feel fairly safe in doing that.
Can we ask who's been vaccinated, or is that again?
I can tell you, I've been vaccinated and a booster. Woo-hoo! I'm telling you.
I'm being boosted on Monday.
I'm vaccinated.
Does this feel okay to talk about for people? Does it make you feel uncomfortable?
Right. Yeah. SOU's got an event tonight. For example, in one of the science lecture halls, that it's public. People can go if they show proof of vaccination and wear a mask. And I think they're going to have folks spread out in Science 118.
Yeah, that was the same way it was for the presidential surge. You had to bring your card. You had to wear a mask.
So if I'm understanding that this group is all vaccinated, we don't know about Kathy, but we can find out the answer to that perhaps.
She is.
Might we want to return to in-person meetings after the first?
You know, I think that's a question at the council too. And so I don't know, you know, I'm not sure, you know, for me, I have to wait for anybody else to say. But
we won't be meeting. We won't be meeting until January. Like in February, that's probably when we'll have our first meeting in person, if everything keeps going the way it's going. February.
Okay. And then the question is to find out whether we can meet in city buildings.
Yeah. Okay. Because our building isn't open to the public now, I think they're just trying to limit the exposure of staff people, you know, to outside people. Okay, so I'm going to need to share my screen, so we'll do that. And I have to tell you, I have notes on this presentation, and the last time I did it, I was able to have it on the screen and see the notes, so but I don't actually know how I did that, so bear with me. Okay, so I do have the presentation up, and I see that it is not in the slide show format. I don't even know if I can do that from here. So can you guys see it okay, or would you like me to try to make it bigger?
Yeah, I can see it in their slides on the left side.
Yeah, because it's not in presentation mode, and I think what I have to do is go back out. But then if I do that, I may not be able to see my notes.
Okay.
Are you guys okay with looking at it in this mode? And then I can just, okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. So this is just a broad overview of the City of Ashland's Affordable Housing Program and Community Development Block Grant Funds. Some of this will be news that you have all heard before or are all familiar with it. Although some things just might be new and interesting or jog your memory. Okay. So the City of Ashland has an affordable housing program. And this is just a little flowchart. We'll talk a little bit about this. And you all get to see my notes too, so it won't be that exciting to you. It won't be new. I am, however, going to collapse this down. Okay. So the City of Ashland Affordable Housing Program consists essentially of myself, which is the housing program specialist, and I oversee two complementary programs, although we could say there's more than just two. the City of Ashland Affordable Housing Program and the Community Development Block Grant Program. And the two programs work together to try to remove barriers and provide incentives in an effort to meet the community's housing needs, which may not be otherwise be met by the private market. The city's affordable housing program is specific to the development of affordable housing types, while the CDBG program is broader in both context and scope, bringing into consideration multiple factors, including community development patterns, social, economic, and environmental justice issues, evaluation of barriers to access to housing, and the development of various housing types and price points, as well as comprehensive community assessments and planning for allocating federal resources. The assessment and planning process for both the housing and the CDBG programs often, as we've experienced recently and in the past, include robust opportunities for community engagement and input. So, so many of you have gone through the consolidated planning process, which I'll talk about in a little more detail later. But, you know, all of it has to be informed by public engagement. So all of these processes, we need to get a lot of feedback from the players. The Housing and Human Services Commission, you, as you know, play a key role in the community engagement process. So you are the conduit by which people can come and give us their feedback. And often you are the ones who enact the community engagement processes so that we can get down to the information, the specific information we need to inform any changes to our programs. So, but you also know that you provide the education and outreach that helps get that feedback to us. Lastly, the housing program specialist, myself, and the Housing and Human Services Commission, all of you, oversee the Social Service Grant Program, as you remember, a program that provides over $100,000 a year in funding to support local organizations in providing needed services. And as with other programs, there is overlap, and you'll see that here in a little bit in these funding sources and activities. So this is probably not new to you, but you know, the term affordable housing is applied to various activities that the city undertakes to address the unmet housing needs within our community. Our program is very unique and nuanced and has evolved over time. And it consists primarily of land use regulations and financial incentives through direct grants and fee waivers. So those are the ways that those are the tools we are using to get affordable housing currently. And I'm going to talk more about those. So here's your column, as you can see. This is the things that you guys do, which is a lot of education and outreach. And then here are some of the land use processes, and we'll talk more in depth about that. And then, of course, there's the grants, which are CDBG, Affordable Housing Trust Fund, Social Service Grants. And then we also have financial incentives. So these are all going to get broken down through fee waivers, such as system development charge deferrals, community development and engineering fee waivers, and then the school construction excise tax. So the city looks at these, all of these activities together as our comprehensive approach to addressing sort of the affordable housing issues with the tools that we have. Let's see, what is my next slide? So here are the financial incentives. I like to call it the carrots and the sticks. So we have some carrots to entice developers to do the things that we want, and we have some sticks to compel them to do the things that we want. Our carrots are primarily these financial subsidies, like the Community Development Block Grant Program, the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, and in certain circumstances over the years, we've also donated city land to projects. And then the other financial incentives are the system development charge deferrals, the waiver of engineering and community development fees, and the school construction excise tax. So just a little background, the city of Ashland began waiving system development charges in the early 90s, 1992 to be specific. And we have changed that program over time as is needed. So what I would say is that all new housing units that are developed in the city have to pay into what are called system development charge fees. And it's essentially, some people call them impact fees. So it's essentially the impact that your housing is going to have on community services. So you know, storm water, sewer, water, you know, water treatment plant, water, just water, regular water. And then streets and parks. So those are the main impacts that are considered in the system development charge deferrals. So in 1992, we would waive the system development charges for newly developed housing units that agreed to be de-restricted to households earning 80% of area median or below, and renting to households earning 60% of area median or below. And they would have to be deed restricted for a period of 20 years, at which time, at the end of that time, we would forgive that deferral. If they sold out of the program or tried to sell for to a market rate household for market rate, then they would have to pay that back with interest. Until that wasn't true for that first iteration, we actually changed that for the second iteration, and we also expanded it to be a 30-year period of affordability rather than a 20-year period. So that's where we're at now. So the funding sources that we have, CDBG comes to us from the federal government. We are an entitlement jurisdiction through HUD, receiving a direct allocation from them. And then through the general fund, we get our support from the marijuana tax, which the Housing and Human Services was instrumental in getting, which funds the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. And then the SDCs and the community development engineering fees are waived, which actually comes out of the general fund as well as a non-collection of fees. So we're going to talk a little bit about what that impact looks like. So this is the Housing Authority of Jackson County, a picture of Snowberry Brook 1 and 2 in the background. The funding mechanisms primarily impact the general fund, either through the non-collection of fees or through the dedication of funds. So the development pictured here, Snowberry Brook 1, received a variety of incentives from the city to make this development possible. And this is a prime example of how these regulatory policies and federal grants and federal fund subsidies can help to incentivize the development of needed housing types. So Snowberry Brook 1 had required affordable housing units as a condition of approval for their annexation. And we'll talk more about the land use pieces in a minute, but that's a land use stick is what we can call it. And they also requested a zone change to increase the number of units that they placed on this land. And so that also compels affordability. And that was actually happened from a private market developer. It wasn't necessarily the Housing Authority, but the Housing Authority inherited that planning approval, or bought it more when they bought the property. So the original development did not move forward, and the city partnered with the Housing Authority by selling some other land to purchase the land with the Housing Authority, because it was more than the Housing Authority could buy by themselves. The city then provided a portion of that land at a reduced cost to the Housing Authority to develop the affordable housing project. So we further subsidized that land so that they would come build here. The Housing Authority also received a community development block grant award to install public facility improvements to access the new housing development. So we paid for the roads and the sidewalks to that on the frontage of that property. And then they also received a waiver of system development charges and community development and engineering fees, which are just essentially processing fees. Lastly, the city housing program specialist, myself, worked with consultants to complete the environmental review assessments for both the Snowberry Brook 1 and 2, which is a requirement of any housing project that receives federal assistance. Another more recent example is the Columbia Care development called Rogue Ridge, which is also under development right now. And that property was awarded a $300,000 Affordable Housing Trust Fund grant to purchase the land in 2018. And then again, staff worked with the project managers and the engineers and some consultants to prepare the environmental assessment. And then lastly, they received a system development charge deferral totaling around $470,000. So altogether, the city has provided out of the general fund, $770,000 for this development, for the Columbia Care development. The Housing Authority's Snowberry Brook 1 development received around $560,000 in SDCs, which were waived. So it was a non-collection of over $500,000 that year by the city. And this is, I would say that the system development charge is the most important incentive that we offer. It is a an incentive that is the difference between somebody building in Medford or White City or Central Point and building in Ashland, because our land is more expensive, but we're essentially saying, you come here and we'll reduce these costs, and that's going to help us level the playing field. So anyway, what I should tell you is that if you have questions about any of these things as I'm talking, like, please feel free to speak up, because I have you minimized, and so I can't see you all. But just, yeah, let me know if you have any questions. And I know this is a lot of information. Lita?
So you're saying that the fees that we give up are actually expensed through the general fund?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, it is. And there is no cap at this point on how much can be expensed in any given year.
Isn't there an amount budgeted for that?
No.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Okay, because, that's bizarre.
Yes. So, you know, it's interesting, and I think it's a whole nother topic, because we don't know who is going to apply and when that will happen in a given year. There was a few years ago, there was a proposal to limit the amount that could be written off in a year to be $100,000 or less. And the council at the time just didn't take it up. But it was after we had, I think, two projects in 1 year, which, you know, was over $500,000. And like I said, you know, then we go for years with no projects, right? So that sometimes we don't waive any fees, or sometimes we waive, you know, $20,000 in fees. Also, we have a backlog of these. So the deferral really works in that we're just not collecting those fees, but they're still on the books until this 30-year period is up, in which time, we could compel them to pay off if they weren't being used in the, you know, inconsistent with the program. So each year, some fall out of the program, not every year, sometimes more than in 1 year. So like 1992 was the first year we did this program, and they had a 20-year period of affordability. So in, 2002 or 2012, we had a bunch that expired. And so they all had to be written off. I mean, we just forgave them, right? Like, your period of affordability is over, and now we reconvey your property, and you're no longer in the program. So we did change the ordinance later to make it a 30-year period with no leaving. After 30 years, you could. And then, of course, we went through a huge process, which some of you may remember, to update our affordable housing program. And we changed some of those things based on feedback that we've gotten over the past 20 years from the development community, from homeowners, a huge variety of people who weighed in on things that just didn't work quite right for them. And mortgage brokers. We did get some mortgage brokers in there. Okay, so this is just a quick breakdown of, how much in 1 year we got in a specific year, which was 2020 through 2021. Not that exciting. You guys know all of this already. So the land use piece is probably the piece you guys are more interested in. So these are the things that we're already doing that are already on the books to compel affordable housing. And I say compel, and I mean, these are the sticks. We talked about the carrots, but these are the sticks. So the housing program has land use policies that, let me minimize this. That support the goal of developing or maintaining needed housing types, such as multifamily and affordable housing. These policies include the condominium conversion ordinance, the annexation ordinance, the zone change ordinance, and the bonus density ordinance. So the annexation and zone change ordinances, I don't know. I'm going to explain this in the way that I think is easiest. So, they essentially say, when you annex a piece of property into the city, you are getting a benefit for that. Come here. And that benefit is worth something.
Annie, come here, Annie.
And for that value, we want some value in return. And that value can be somewhat defined by you, in that you can propose what income level your new housing units that you're going to build will be targeted to. And so that range is used to be 60% of area median income, up to 120% of area median income. And you still can do that. But what we changed in most recent years is that you can no longer do ownership housing for people earning 60% of area median income or below, because what we were seeing is that there were no lending programs to help these lower income families or households buy these housing units. You can still do rental housing at 60%. And so the way the annexation and zone change ordinances work is that if you provide for the lowest incomes, then you can provide the least amount of units, the lowest percentage. But if you provide housing units to the higher income, 120%, which is essentially market rate almost, then you're going to have to provide a much larger percentage. The condominium conversion ordinance was passed in 2007 when the city saw a lot of rental housing units converted to condominiums. And so the city passed a requirement that said if you convert condominiums or convert rental housing to condominiums, you have to provide a certain percentage of those as affordable housing. And so we have some of those in our units. And then the density bonus is an interesting one that so that I did write it out because this is, I think it's interesting. So it allows a builder to develop more units if a portion of them are affordable. So obviously all of these programs work best for affordable housing developers, but the incentive is based, and thus when it costs more to develop a home than it can be rented or sold for, developers do not use this bonus density. So that's what we found, is that private market wasn't using it at all. And so we looked back at like, why are they not using this? Why wouldn't they just build another unit? And it was because it was one for one. So they were like, oh, it just costs us money to do it. So in 2014, we changed it to say you can build two market rate units if you give us one affordable housing unit. And that's going to offset the costs enough to make it, you know, pencil out for you. So interestingly enough, I think that's only happened once since we changed it. So still, I mean, so this is kind of the thing that we do in our program with these tools, is that we look at, you know, how is this working? Are we getting what we are wanting? If we're not getting it, then why aren't we getting it? And, you know, we're not developers. We're not in the development world. We don't know what mortgage lenders are doing. We don't know what commercial lenders are doing. We don't know, you know, what material costs or labor costs. I mean, we're just not on top of what's going on because we don't develop. And so our tools have to be informed by the people who are doing the building in order for us to make them work and make them want to participate in our programs. So that was kind of the process we went through a couple of year and a half ago to update our affordable housing program, was to be really responsive to how come we're, you know, we have these incentives. Why aren't you doing these things? And then we heard from them. And then we said, okay, how should we change our incentives to make it work for you? Like, what will compel you? So we did change them. Now we'll see. I am going to read this because I think it's interesting. So these mechanisms provide a variety of tools with which to incentivize the provision of affordable housing to a range of incomes that are not currently met by the market, right? That's what our role is. At present, the city's program covers somewhere around 170 units. So that's how many units have been created since essentially 1992, though some fall out of the program as well. Some of these units are rentals. And these tend to be owned and managed by affordable housing providers, mostly. And the majority of the units that the city oversees the transfer of are either owner-occupied units or rental units, which also may be offered for sale. So the most of the things that I do on a day-to-day basis, well, not even, I don't know, sometimes, some of my job is dealing with the transfer of these properties from one household to another. So here are some other land use things that the city has done, which does not deed restrict the units. So all the other stuff, we deed restrict those units. There is a recorded document lien on that property that says you can't do these things with it. We can talk a little bit about how that can go awry. But so there's other things that we do that sort of feel like they can incentivize affordable housing types, but they're not deed restricted. So, you know, there's no legal document that says these have to rent or sell at a certain rate, you know, to certain households below a certain income level. So the city of Ashland, along with a lot of other cities these days, we do allow accessory dwelling units or accessory residential units outright in all residential zones in Ashland, with only the issuance of a building permit. So remove all the barriers, try to make it as easy as possible for people to develop this housing type. And we have no parking requirements for them either. The city of Ashland passed a cottage housing code, which means that, you know, you can develop any lot in a single family residential zone as multiple small houses, or, you know, instead of one large house. And then similarly, which is part of the state of Oregon's requirements, all duplex dwelling units are allowed outright in any residential zone in Ashland with only the building issuance of a building permit. And duplexes are just required to have one parking space. So reducing the parking, which is often a barrier, but also, you know, trying to get more density on the existing land and not have that prohibition about, you know, single family residentially zoned lands. And then minimum densities. So to ensure that the limited supply of multifamily zoned land is not developed as single family detached homes, the city requires minimum densities in multifamily zones. So you have to develop a certain number of units in these zones. And then mixed use developments, the city allows residential uses above commercial ground floors to try to maximize that residential development. So these are just some policies that the city has already enacted that are seen as being able to create a little more reasonable housing or different housing types. So that's the land.
Lisa, can I ask you a question?
Yes, I was going to stop here so that we can have a minute to talk about these things, because I know that was a lot. I'm sorry.
My question is, do we have any data on the number of ADUs that have been put in place since we eliminated all of the requirements?
You know, it's funny that you ask, because I was going to ask today. We just eliminated those in the last year. And so the city of Ashland actually participated in an ADU study quite a while back, because a huge percentage of the new housing developed in Ashland is ADUs, because we actually had a lot of other regulatory barriers removed to the development of ADUs. So last year we had 19 developed within the city, which I know doesn't sound like a lot, but as a percentage of our overall development, it's generally like 25% or something of all new housing units built in Ashland. So I will get data on that because I need to check with our permit technicians and have them pull those. When we participated in that study, the study was Portland, Eugene, and Ashland. Those were the three communities in the state of Oregon that produced the most ADUs every year.
You know, Linda, I have a quick question. I was reading, but I don't know if it was on the slide, ADUs, the acronyms. I was thinking, I know Kathy's not here and she'll look at this later, but Joy is here so that our new commissioners will know what these acronyms are.
Yeah, it's additional dwelling unit is what ADU stands for. And a lot of communities call them accessory residential units. They're the same exact thing. It's just Ashland has been saying additional dwelling unit for a long time, so it gets confusing.
And Linda, is there a way that this can be sent to the commissioners so that maybe we can all take a longer look at this on our own? Or is this going to be archived and we can look at it? How can we access this after this meeting?
I am going to put it in the minutes as a link. I can put it on the city's website probably, because I'm not sure how I'll do it. It'll be in the minutes, maybe as a link on the website. But either way, yeah, I know it's a lot of information. And honestly, I'm sure it's a little bit dry. So I apologize for that in advance. Rich? Rich, you got muted again somehow, I think.
I just keep doing that. But I think Echo is, well, anyway, I just had a couple of comments about the zoning part that you've talked about. One is that we refer to it as zoning change or something else, and it's really inclusionary zoning. And that's where everybody in the country calls it inclusionary zoning. And we had it as the only city that could do it. Just make sure that everybody knows the history of it, because again, it was outlawed in the state by developers, but the legislature fought back and they allowed it, but we still don't do it to the full extent that we can. But the other point that I wanted to look at was the House Bill 2001. And Ashland takes a lot of credit for saying for cities under 25,000, we allow duplexes in single family zones. But every city above 25,000 has to add triplexes, quads, and cottages also within single family zones. And there's nothing in the law that prevents us from doing that. And Talent has, in fact, already done that, even though they're a town that's way much smaller than we are. So that's another direction that we could go that would strengthen what we already are doing. The duplexes is a nice thing. If we go over 25,000 in population, then we're required within a year to do that. But there's nothing that keeps us from doing it now. I'm done.
Echo?
Two things. I've talked to Kathy a little bit just because we know each other. You know, we have other hats that we share. So I know she's going to be particularly interested in seeing what Ashland can do to incentivize adding some mobile home construction. It's occurred to me, looking at the aftermath of the fire, that for a lot of fire survivors, mobile homes, and in fact, even RVs, are really low-income single-family residential units. And a lot of people really want a single-family residential unit, even if it's only a mobile home or even an RV in a stable RV parking situation. They would really prefer to not share walls with other people in a townhome or duplex. And so I think we should maybe think a little bit about mobile homes as on a continuum of single family residential. Even though that seems weird to people, I don't think it seems weird to the people who live in them. And I'm thinking about Rich's son, for example, who probably thought of his home in Bear Creek development as his single family residential home. And then the second thing I want, and I put it in the chat, I read recently that the city of Eugene is offering at no charge pre-approved ADU architectural plans to people who are willing to construct them or want to construct them. What I don't know from what I read in the Register Guard was whether or not there are any strings attached that require those ADUs to be used for something like housing rather than as VRBOs or Airbnbs. If they're actually used, yeah, if they're not, if they're being used really for how, you know, basically tiny homes rather than being used as vacation rental. But I think having pre-approved ADU architectural plan shouldn't be that heavy of a lift for the city of Ashland. That seems entirely doable to me. We could steal them from Eugene because they're offering them for free.
We tried to have a grant.
Yes. Yeah, we did. So Rich is right. About 5 years ago, Rich, you know, it kind of drives me crazy because there's two communities that are doing that. And I'm sure it wasn't my idea solely. But that was my idea. So I wrote a grant like 5 years ago I met with architects and I said, what would it take for you to draw up plans that we could go through pre-engineering and all we have to do? Like, we will make a pamphlet and we can give a pamphlet to people and we can say, here's your three plans. You pick them, you tell us where it's going to be and we'll get right through it. And our grant did not get funded.
You know.
Hmm.
Lita, did you want to say something? Then I'll go after Lita.
Yeah. Oh, wait, I think I'm muted. No, I'm not muted.
You're okay.
A neighbor friend is having an ADU built on her property. And when we saw the blueprints, and actually a friend of mine's moving up into it, but when we saw the blueprints, we noticed, and I'd be really surprised if it's not just the template that the developers are already using. So it should be a fairly simple thing to offer a couple of, you know, two or three of them that people are already doing for depending on the size of the plot, you know?
You know, I wanted to jump in and say last week or a week and a half ago, I went to Central Point to this new company. They're called Pack Wall. And Pack Wall, what they do is they actually put together the ADU and then drop it off at the property and just put it up like a little Lego set. And the developer, you don't actually need a developer. You can do it online for free yourself. It is very, the company is called Pack Wall. They're in Central Point. The owner lives here in Ashland. He wanted to build at the Croman Mill, but he couldn't because the SDCs are so expensive. So he went to Central Point. But this, I can definitely put their information in the chat. They put it together and they drop it off at your location and you just bring it up like a little house. And something that what they do, the total cost of what they do for the framing and the foundation was $22,000. He said that you could build a whole home for about $80,000 to $90,000 with the plumbing, the whole nine yards.
Amazing.
So the lead up, just in answer to your question, we met with architects to find out, you know, how much would it cost for us to get plans that are, you know, template plans that we can give out to everybody. And I guess the big issue is that for architects, they need to make money, and selling one set of plans to you to be used over and over and over again was a little problematic for them. So we had actually devised, we worked with Steve Ennis, who used to be on the board of the Ashland Community Land Trust and who's a longtime community member and is very community minded. And we had devised a part of our grant was that we would work with young architects to design these as a way for them to get their name out there and that they wouldn't mind having their product replicated essentially for free rather than sort of having, you know, earning money that way. And Pacific Wall Systems, so the place you're talking about, Gina, used to be called Pacific Wall Systems, structurally insulated panel, wall panel systems. And that was actually used in Rice Park, in the Rice Park development. So that was the first time we had heard about them. And I think it's a great way to go. I mean, there's a lot of efficiencies to be had, which is, you know, the one thing about ADUs is that they're very hard for us to deed restrict. So I did work with a former housing commissioner. She was great. I don't know if any of you know her. Her name is Barbara Barassa. She was on the housing commission for many years. She actually she was part of the original Rice Park development, and she had lobbied to get some of our manufactured home standards changed because she actually decided she wanted to do that instead, but found some barriers in our code. And so because of her, we were able to clean up the code a bit to make it easier for manufactured housing to be placed anywhere in the city. And then she ended up building an ADU. So she ended up finding a house that she could buy, and she built an ADU. And so she and I worked together to see if it would work for her to get it deed restricted as affordable. And it didn't, because the way our program is structured, the maximum rental price was way lower than essentially her mortgage payment on the cost to build the unit. So, I think those are the sorts of things that are, you know, the reality in my mind, the reality of the challenges of how we can compel the market to provide the things that we really want or really need. We have this great tool, but it just isn't going to fit for all applications. And can we make it fit? Or is that, you know, something that is just, it's too far of a stretch. So that was what we learned through our development process with update process with our affordable housing resolutions was that the subsidy between what it costs to build things right now being like a year and a half ago or more, versus the maximum amounts that we allow things to sell and rent for in our program is so great that private market developers are just not that enticed by it. They need a partner. So that's what we came to in the end, was that they need an affordable housing partner who has access to different funding mechanisms to bring that subsidy down enough to make it pencil. And so after we changed our ordinance, Mark Knox partnered with KDA Homes, partnered with Habitat for Humanity to provide the affordable housing component of an annex property, and then they'll provide the market rate. So this was the first foray after we changed our ordinance to essentially allow, we always allowed private market developers to, would give the land or even sell the land at whatever negotiated price they came to an affordable housing provider to meet that requirement. But this time what we did was we said, like, we're going to allow you to transfer the land in advance, just some sort of weird regulatory things that had never been worked out, because we always just assumed that the private market developers would just build it. And our assumption was wrong. Over the course of many years, it just didn't happen. And we realized this is why. But it took us talking to them to find out, getting feedback from them. Actually, I had someone, even though this is recorded, I had someone come to me and say, well, you designed your program so that no one would build affordable housing. And I was like, who would take the time to design a program like that? Why would you think we would waste time to do that? And he said, well, the way it's written, you make it so it's impossible for us to do this. And I was like, you tell me which parts are impossible and we will work to make it possible. Like, we don't know what that is. Obviously, we didn't design it that way. So then we got some feedback. Okay, I'm digressing and we'll never get through this.
Well, I would like for us to be able to take a look at that, because they have built many ADUs in Medford, and they're shipping them down south also. So just take a look at their website. It's very informative.
That's exciting. Maybe we could get them to come in and talk to the commission at some point in the future. So this next section is really about the CDBG program, and I'm probably not going to go as in-depth into that as the regulatory stuff. So what do you think, Linda? Linda, you're muted.
Sorry. We're at the time limit that we set for this.
Okay.
And it's a very valuable discussion. But I'm wondering if we want to put it into two blocks and maybe do the other half of it at our next meeting. How far are you, halfway in?
I think it would be good to do it in another block if you guys are okay with that, because I think the next part is just more about CDBG and the things that CDBG has done. But I guess I would defer to you guys. I know it's just so much information to give you all at once. How are you
feeling? I was feeling like it's a lot to absorb, and it would be better to do it in another block. And also, I don't want to shortchange it, because I think this is incredibly valuable. We sort of designed this for the new people, but I don't know about the rest of you, who qualify as old people like I do. But I find it incredibly valuable too. There's a lot of pieces of this that I didn't know, or I'm understanding more fully now. So I would like to give it a full block of time in our next meeting to maybe do the rest of this. Anybody else? Anybody want to comment?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, good idea. I agree.
Okay, great. So I'm going to stop my screen share now, and we will pick up where we left off, which is slide 11 next month.
Great. Linda, thank you. This is really helpful. I know you spent some time putting this together, and I want to say I really appreciate it. I think this is really important for us. First of all, for all of us to get up to speed and be in the kind of the same understanding of things, but it's a good refresher course for all of us, I think. I'm just grateful. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it helps to understand why things are so slow to change.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's also very helpful to have you, to have Rich, to have Heidi, to have people who have a really big depth of experience. When you start talking about what happened in the 1992, I'm like, wow, there are people who remember that. That's great. We're going to move on in our agenda to the severe climate event policy stakeholder meeting and discussion. We've had Joy and Echo and Rich working on this as a subcommittee. And I'm not sure which of you or all of you who's going to present, but you're on. Unmute.
Echo, why don't you do it?
Sure, I will do my best to be brief. not my strong suit. Linda and Linda Reed and I and Joy met, and then Joy was traveling, and then Linda and Rich and I met. So we've had a couple of meetings. I've been doing some homework, looking at additional models in addition to what Medford's policy and process is for declaring a cooling shelter. So I've gotten some feedback from the Community Action Agency up in Hood River and from folks at Salem, and there's stuff. There's tons of models that other cities use online. There are cooling centers really throughout the West in particular popping up. So we have lots of things we can steal ideas from is the short story, in addition to what Medford's already doing. So the next step then, after kind of talking about what the issues were, was, okay, we need to have stakeholders involved, particularly around the issue of sites that are stable, that we can count on for multiple days and overnights, and the usual suspects for sites in most cities, including our area, are going to be churches and some nonprofits. Linda and Rich and I and Joy have brainstormed a list of possible participants, the interfaith community. Linda Reed, you've got the names on the surface of your brain better than I do. So a letter has gone out. Linda crafted a lovely letter that's gone out to folks, inviting them to a couple of stakeholder brainstorming conversation meetings. The first one on November 9th during the day, and then an evening meeting on November 11th in the evening, in hopes that with two times we'll get some folks to show up. I think the agenda for those meetings, we still haven't quite figured that out, Rich and Joy. We don't have like standard agenda yet, but it's not hard to imagine what it will be. It will be like, here's the need. We know the need is going to be with us for a long time because climate change is going to drive the need for cooling and smoke shelters as well.
A year-round kind of thing at this point.
Well, I think it probably won't be year-round. I mean, there'll be warming shelters. We already have processes in place for warming shelter. It's adding the cooling and smoke shelter that's new. And I don't think there will be resources for year-round. I don't think. But we'll see what happens in the conversations. I mean, there's certainly need, but is there capacity? And I don't think there's going to be capacity.
Did I misunderstand you saying that there is not going to be a winter shelter?
No, there is a winter shelter. But we already kind of know what the city does with winter shelter. We have more of a track record with that, which Heidi's done forever. And Ora's done. And we have pallet shelters. So we have more pieces already in place. For warming shelters, are those pieces enough? No. But what we really don't have any pieces for are cooling and smoke, except what you did, Joy, kind of throwing things together almost on your own last summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my sense of the meetings on the 9th and the 11th is... I thought, I mean, I could be wrong, but I was thinking probably cooling shelters are going to be the major focus of those, although warming shelters are certainly still important. Anyway, I'll stop talking.
So I have a question. So do we have an existing policy that around heating specifically, around what temperature requirements are and that sort of thing?
Yes. And you weren't here at the last meeting, but it was in that packet. We've actually had some sort of I think it's called the inclement weather shelter ordinance, and it has evolved. We actually have had three of them over the years, and the most recent one is probably the one that Heidi could speak most to, because the thing about this, what I would say about this ordinance, the thing that I find interesting about it is that while it does have parameters, the main focus of it is that the city administrator can call an inclement weather shelter at any time. And so it really is like, sure, whatever the temperature is, but it doesn't matter because you can ask them and then they can call a shelter, which is honestly how we get shelters, because you look at the weather and you're like, hey, it looks like it's going to be cold. Can we call a shelter? And then they'll be like, okay. But in the past, with an old inclement weather shelter, it came with things, mostly just Pioneer Hall was the only thing it came with. Although I think it also had something about or another city building, which we often didn't have access to any other city building except Pioneer Hall. So we do have one, but it doesn't address anything else. No smoke, no heat.
So what is the temperature requirement? Is there a number?
Mm-hmm. What is it, Heidi, 22?
It was 20 or below, depending on other factors that might make the wind chill factor. And so this feels like we come full circle again. I did this for years, and it was really difficult to do emergency shelter because while we had a lot of volunteers for winter overnight shelters, we had certain nights and it was predictable how many volunteers we'd need each night. And we had set locations, even though it changed from one church to Pioneer Hall or another place, it was predictable and we had great volunteers. But for, I think in 2017, I met with the city council and Mayor Stromberg at that time met with a number of us who were acting as volunteers for the emergency shelters. And what I said, it was very difficult to, on a moment's notice, set up an emergency shelter, not knowing what space would be available to house 50 people, and find volunteers on the spur of the moment. So that's when the city said, we'll take responsibility for some of that. We'll pay volunteers to spend the night. And it will make a greater incentive for volunteers to, on the spur of the moment, to volunteer. And it did make it easier. The difficult part for me as the coordinator was I'd have to call all over the city to churches and city buildings, which were often rented out for that particular night, then go all around town putting up notices, making sure the vulnerable people knew where the shelter was going to be, and all this within a matter of hours. So it was really challenging. And then the city authorized a contract with Aura to have paid coordinators to do that work, which was great for me because I was still coordinating the regular winter shelters, and it just took a lot of work off my plate. So now here we are back in a similar situation with Linda Reed playing my old role, and it's challenging to do that work. We still have, because Aura is now well funded by lots of different grants,
we still have that huge, I think it was 250 volunteers that I had at one point, and I still have all their emails and everything. But all those folks are not volunteering much at this point in time because of COVID. We did also do some hot weather stretches at the end of the time I was doing it, a couple in high wind and hot temperatures. But that was at Pioneer Hall before it was condemned. So I have great empathy for this problem, and yet I don't want to take it on in the way I've taken it on for years. But so, I contribute emails, email names and email addresses to solicit volunteers, but that's the smallest piece of it.
Rich?
Well, I just want to comment that we have an opportunity. The city council asked us to come up with the policies for cooling shelters and for heating shelters. We've researched all of them around the state, and we're bringing together stakeholders. So those stakeholders are going to get a say in something, and we ought to propose not what's, this is what should be done, and that can be changing the temperature, it can be setting who is responsible for it, and particularly, we need to collaborate with all of these folks. If we have to guilt them out or something, in other communities, people are stepping up and doing what needs to be done. And we need to say to them, here's your opportunity to do this. But we need to say to the city council, we're going to give you the parameters for both of those. And I would just say, Jackson County Democrats, their health commission, health caucus, has set the policies for heating and cooling shelters as a resolution. They're going to move through local communities and the state based on some of the work that we're doing. And other communities and other collaborations are looking to Ashland to come up with something. So what we do and what we recommend here can go beyond just our city. So it's a lot to look at, and hopefully we'll get it done and back to our November meeting.
That's really why I was asking the question, because I think we have been asked to send a policy, and not necessarily the process or the who's going to do it, but right now we're being asked to present a draft policy. And this is to a city that 4 years ago, the policy said 20 degrees in the wintertime. I'm not comfortable having somebody have that range of options. I'd like a policy that says something that won't let people die in the cold. So I really want numbers as part of that policy. That's my take on it. Joy?
I'm giving you numbers. 35 degrees or below, or if it is precipitating simultaneously, make it at 45. You can get hypothermia and severe complications at 45 when you are soaking wet in the rain. And as far as the temperatures, I said 95 degrees or above, with a smoke recommendation unhealthy for sensitive groups or above.
Is that the policy that the committee wants to recommend that we send to city council?
No, I'm telling you, that's what I said to them and what I find is working in my shelter.
Echo.
And so there's public health guidance out there, which is why we need a public health person at these meetings. And I'm getting an echo from somebody's microphone, so sorry about that. Not sure where it's coming from. There's considerable variability around the country about where those temperature trigger points are. There's what Medford does. And so one easy thing to do is to just copy what Medford does. Personally,
I'm a little bit more thinking what Joy's thinking, that those trigger points need to be higher trigger points in winter for warming shelters and lower trigger points around 95 degrees, for example, in summer. But there's going to be disagreement about that. It's hard to come up with a definitive answer. But there is public health research that we can use to say, this is what public health people say when you have temperatures at a certain level, certain humidity levels on top of smoke. And so here's the health guidance. So do we act on the health guidance, or do we say that we do not have the capacity to protect people's public health, which may be in fact the reality. The other way that we guilt people besides the public health appeal, or motivate people is probably a better word than saying guilting people, is to say that this is a climate change issue, because there are folks in the community for whom that's the most important thing to talk about. So we appeal to another segment of the community by framing this as a climate change topic. And that makes complete and total sense. And then there's a third segment of the community who's going to be motivated to participate with a moral, ethical, spiritual, religious, faith-based appeal. And so I think we use all three of those frames to motivate people to participate and to see that they have a common interest in keeping people alive in both winter and summer and smoke. Now, the other thing that Rich has really emphasized, and I'm going to speak for him because I know he's probably thinking about this, is the importance on having clarity about communication between the different sites and the different organizations and the city to declare the need for a shelter. And that's something that Rich has talked about a lot, so I'll not talk about that and let him speak to that issue if he wants.
Before you speak, Rich, I would just, I need to know, do you want a recommendation out of this commission tonight? Rich is saying you want to go to the city council in November. It needs to come to us to go to the city council.
No, I think where we're at is that by the November meeting, we would have a set of policy recommendations to you all. And then however that gets to the city council, that'll sort of be on there, and Gina can help us with that. But I think we ought to see if we can get both some agreement with stakeholders and ourselves to come up with something specific for the November meeting.
Gina.
Thanks, Linda. Quick question. I think it was asked earlier that I believe, Linda, you said that Linda Reed has the list of the stakeholders. I think that if you know who these stakeholders are, like you said, Rich, we got to collaborate and come together at the table. So before November, would that letter go out to these stakeholders so that you can have that conversation, and we at least that could be presented at the November 16th meeting, and maybe we can have some feedback from the stakeholders, yes, we'll be there, this is our date, or however you want to proceed?
Yes, we have already scheduled the meetings, and we have emailed out the letters with the meeting dates and asked people to respond. And I emailed them out. I emailed the letter out to you all so you could see it as well. And then I did request that if there were people that you thought might be interested in weighing in on this discussion, if you wanted to just go ahead and forward that invitation to them, I think that would be great too, because we did brainstorm a great list of people, but I'm sure there are people that maybe we didn't think about. And just for my own edification, based on the conversations that we've had as groups over the past, in the work group in the past few meetings, I put together this memo that sort of summarized all the things that we had talked about. And while we don't have an agenda quite yet for the meeting, I mean, we do know that the topics are, you know, what resource needs do we have? What temperature thresholds? What are we looking at? And that's sort of the feedback that we were hoping to get from the stakeholders. But if there are other items that you guys think that we are missing, or that questions that we should specifically be asking stakeholders about, you know, please feel free to let me know, or let all of us know what those things might be, because it certainly there may be things that we're not thinking about.
Jackie.
Well, one of the things, this whole thing, you know, concerns me greatly. And of course, we're going right into this very cold temperature coming up. It could be an extremely cold weather. That's what the weather forecasts are saying. It's very cold and very long. So that's sort of a climate change kind of thing. But the one of the biggest concerns I have is meeting with the stakeholders. Of course, you have to find where you can put the people. And then you have to find, how do you pay and find the person who is going to be the communicator for getting the people into whatever site can be found. And we're in this transition with COVID. And my concern is that I think there are people, churches possibly, there might be businesses possibly, that might provide spaces down the road. But for people to be doing it right now for this coming winter, which is right around the corner, I think we're almost in a crisis emergency kind of a situation that's just going to be getting worse and worse. So I just would like to put a little emergency on this. Because I've done the dance with trying to find locations for shelter in Ashland, and it was very difficult. And you know, we looked at Pioneer Hall, and we found, you know, the Fifth Street Church, but it's very, very difficult. And now with COVID laid over that, I'm sorry, I don't have an answer. And one thing I want to point out, the more you make the temperatures better for people to get shelter, you know, so instead of saying 20 degrees, you say 32 degrees with, you know, temperature issues, you get an increase in the number of people who are going to come to the shelter. And so these are factors that can play, you know, against each other in the process of finding a location. So I'm sorry I'm pointing out sort of negative things, but I think we've got to be clear on what we're dealing with here.
Okay. I want to go back to Echo, because we sort of cut you off and took off running. You still have some more presentation to make, right?
Well, no, not really. I mean, it's we've already covered stuff. I mean, we've got, I think I'm just sort of trying to brainstorm a little bit what the agenda might be. So, you know, you start off with, why have we all asked you here today? You know, like, so what do we know about the level of need? We have some numbers, particularly for warming shelters in the winter. We don't have particularly good numbers for the demand for cooling, except, you know, what Joy experienced this last summer, perhaps. And I don't know if Heidi has information going back to prior years or not around that. We know some data around what the weather was like from the Ashland Fire Department website. There were 28 days of AQI over 100, which is unhealthy for sensitive groups. There were 11 days of AQI over 150, which is unhealthy for everybody. I believe there was at least 35 days over 95 degrees, and maybe that many, even close to 100 or up to 111. And then you can factor in the number of nights in the summer that didn't go below 70. So there's all sorts of possible numbers, Linda Rapond, that different cities use. And I can totally nerd out on that. So I don't want to nerd too much on you. So there's like, you know, so you lay out the reasons to do it. Then you talk about the level of need that we have in the community that we have some data for. Then we talk about what we have been doing and what we know
isn't enough. And then we try to figure out using a what's called an asset-based community development model. So what assets, what resources do we have in the community to meet the needs that we know that we have? And then try to get people on board with stabilizing sites, making them predictable, getting as many nights, as many days as we possibly can. We know it's not going to be enough. It would be great if we had a year-round shelter in the city of Ashland, but I think that's unlikely. Are there public buildings we can be using in addition to churches? There are lots of things that other communities do. We can throw all those ideas out there for people to kind of get them brainstorming about what our community assets actually are. And then we have some really hard conversations to have with our own moral compasses about, you know, what is our collective responsibility to not let people die? So that's where my head's at.
So can I just ask Joy to weigh in on this? I feel like you've given your whole life to this in the last year and longer than that.
Yeah. Boy. It's an incredibly challenging job. And I think that having a dedicated year-round space is important for a lot of different reasons. Just because there haven't been any in the past doesn't mean there won't be in the future. And I'm kind of getting irritated about hearing, well, we don't have any. There's some miracle, believe me. Shelters, winter warming shelters are critical here. The temperatures change dramatically fast. Usually people are carrying a 25 to 65 pound rucksack on their back. If they're tired, they're wet, they need dry socks, they need a dinner. You know, I've got sleeping bags, mats out. It's when it's hot, you know, 95 and above is usually when I'll keep the doors open. I've had seniors toddle in here. You know, I mean, it's brutal for people who are older or have health issues or what have you. It's just, you know, I guess I just do it. If it needs to be done, I do it. And I'm not quite sure. I can, if you tell me, okay, what do I need to open up a shelter? I would say, okay, I need a building and I need some tables and I need some mats and I need X amount of pillows and I'm going to have this for the refrigerator and we're going to have plumbing facilities and sanitizers and stuff to keep the place clean. And I mean, I can tell you all those things. I do it on the daily. Finding a space, you can, if you don't have a space, all the talking in the world isn't going to really do a whole lot. So I think finding a space, maybe the city has a space that we can somehow get a grant to rent from the city so that it could be a year-round facility. Lots of stuff happens between summer and winter that, you know, people still need homes. They're still suffering. They're still, you know, dying. And I'm not exaggerating. So, and yeah, it's above my pay grade, but if it weren't me, it wouldn't be anybody. And so I'll give it my best out. I can tell you about what kind of volunteers to get. I can tell you what attitude works and what attitude will be conflicting in shelter. You know, I'm more like boots on the ground, making it happen, trying to tell you what we need to make it go forward. I hope that's helpful.
Yes.
It's hard for me to talk about permits and getting houses and backyards just at this particular moment, but because this is my busy season, like I'm open Sunday through Thursday, and they're all overnight days. And so I've got 15 to 18 people per night getting fed, cared for, slept, you know, they're safe, get up, get them out, you know, something in their bellies, wish them a good day. And then I start cleaning the shelter because I have protocols to keep clean and whatnot.
Jackie.
Joy, just to clarify for me, are you at the Fifth Street Church, the Shepherd?
The auxiliary building, yeah.
Okay.
That's where, yeah.
Yeah, that's and I appreciate so much what you are doing. I can't thank you enough. I mean, it's just incredible. I wanted to just mention another way of thinking possibly that has come with the pallet shelters, that instead of looking for necessarily a building, that we could possibly be looking at a piece of land. And I know we went through that with finding, you know, 2082 East Main with the county to put up that urban campground. But, you know, we could do that again in another, if we could just find the land, yeah, that we could put up more pallet shelters. So I think we just sort of have to open up our thinking. And when you get people separated and outside more in those pallet shelters, I think that lends itself probably to a better health situation with the whole COVID thing. So I just wanted to mention that.
It does. It absolutely does. It helps to feel like there's part of a community. And I know that there are certain parameters that are needed to set up those pallet homes, and they come with all kinds of amenities. And I personally would like to ensure that there is some kind of moral oversight or ethical oversight or some kind of an oversight committee, that if they're getting grants that provide pallet homes that have access to heat and all those kinds of things, that they are actually being utilized when they are on site.
Yes.
If you get my drift.
We're going to need to move on because we're running out of time again. I just want to say it's incredibly valuable to have you in this conversation, Joy, and Heidi before you, people who've done this day in and day out, year in and year out, is just it's a perspective that those of us who haven't don't have unless you share. So thank you.
Can we hear from Chris really quick? Or no?
Pardon? What did you say, Gina?
Chris had his hand up for
a really Chris, long yes.
time. I'll try to be brief. I just was wondering, when's the last time we revisited asking SOU and their spaces, especially with Stevenson Union? I know I'm here right now. It's not being utilized. No one's here. You know, we got a lot of big spaces on the second floor and also on the first floor. So I didn't know, when's the last time we revisit that conversation.
Can they be one of the stakeholders that we invite to this, send them a letter and see what
they are. We Greg Perkinson, and I believe we put one of the Board of Trustees members on the invite lead at list as well.
Awesome.
So
what else do you need from us to shape what you bring back to us next month? Anything else at this moment from the commission?
I think, if some of you can come to those meetings on the 9th or on the 11th, that would be really great. You know, Joy's obviously and Heidi's had the most in-depth experience. And Linda, you've certainly saved people's lives with the rooms in your place as well. So props to you. I did want to mention one thing that Joy mentioned at a work group meeting that I hadn't realized. Gil Livney has been paying the electric bill out of his own pocket at that church. And yeah, that's awesome. But I'm feeling a little bad about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'm wondering if we could rectify that situation somehow.
Gina?
Actually, I was not going to speak to that, but I wish I, when we look at these shelters and where people are going to stay, and something was brought up because of COVID has to be multiple shelters, I would like for the city to be able to support that in any way that might look like for any given shelter, because we will have to have it managed and overseen. And I mean, when this man, God bless him, has been doing this for out of the kindness of his heart, I think that should be appreciated.
Yes.
For 3 years almost.
Heidi, and then we're going to move on.
When I was doing shelters a long time ago, I approached Access, and they had grants that they would give us for supplies. You didn't have to be a nonprofit, but if you were a church or you had some kind of nonprofit-like status, I think the one of the first years they gave us $20,000 to buy mats and a little trailer to store them in. And I think some of those are still around. Has the committee...
They were great. We still have them.
Oh, good. Has the committee talked to like John Wachorek and other people who used to do the supply chain for the shelters, for the winter shelters?
Will you reach out to John, Heidi? I know that he kind of, you know, he was super involved for a while, but then he had to drop out because he had some other things to deal with. And so I haven't talked to John, and I didn't invite him to the stakeholder meeting. I don't know if there's any value to doing that. I mean, not that there isn't any value, that's not the right word, whether that's something he would be interested in doing right now. But could you reach out to him? And also, I kind of wanted to check in with Ruth and Barbie, but I don't know that they're,
Can you send me a list of people you've sent invitations to? And have you personally talked to some of... No. Well, that's something I could help with. If you send me a list of all the people you've sent letters to, I can reach out and call some of the people that I used to work with that, you know, I think would still have an interest in helping.
That'd be great. Thank you. I'll do that tomorrow.
I did hear the request that as many commissioners as are available to come to at least one of those two meetings would be helpful. So we got a lot on the docket here. The next thing on our agenda is our report to the council, which also happens in that same block of time in November. The 16th of November is the annual report to the city council. And Linda's put together some information about that. What do you need from us in short order here?
We have done a lot in the last year and a half. Last year, you know, some of our meetings were truncated. We didn't meet all the time. And when we did meet, it was really to just get through, honestly, what was a lot of stuff on our agenda because it was, had been, you know, backed up for months and we were just trying to get things done that needed to get done. So I didn't want to give the commission short shrift in this description of, you know, what has happened in the past year and a half. So please, and what I would say is we don't have to do it verbally now, but if you have anything that you feel like should be included in this report to the council, please email it to me only. I will make all of the changes and email everyone out a copy of the finished report. I do need you to designate who will present to the council in the November meeting.
Rich, would you do it with me if I said yes?
I'll be a silent partner, but I'll be there. Yeah.
Okay, I'm willing. Unless somebody else is like really wants to share that, to have that stage. So if I'm going to be the one, I agree with Linda Reed. Please send in your comments when you read this of things you want to make sure are highlighted. in the presentation.
Yeah, and I just, so what I did was I included the last one that we did, which was in 2019, I think. And then I don't believe we did one in 2020. So this is actually the highlighted or the bolded underlined is what happened in 2020 and in 2021. So I feel like there may be more, and I just included the 2019 to kind of give you an idea of the things that we've talked about in the past. Thank you. And I will put Linda and Rich down as presenters.
So at some point in the future, I think we should perhaps do the liaison reports at the beginning of the meeting, because here it is 2:02 and we're ready for reports again.
May I have those 2 minutes?
Go right ahead.
Thank you. I'll be quick. I just wanted to ask everyone, if you have time on November 1st, please come to the meeting, the council meeting. At this meeting, we are going to discuss the 100 and I think it's 95 units that's going to be over there off of Highway 99. It's the second reading of the land use. And I think it's important that everybody is there. Also, I did hear Jackie question Iowa Street. It's 72 units. All I know is it's been approved, but no movement on that. And council did give the thumbs up to KDA Homes for 192 Mountain Avenue that was annexed. So that's going to have 52 homes. Out of the 52 homes, 8 of them are going to be affordable. And it's kind of, 52, all we get is 8. They're just doing the minimum. I mean, what they need to do. But the best part about it is that these homes are 4-bedroom, 2-bath. That's a good thing. And they're going to be in the mix with all the rest of the homes. So I'm very excited about that. And also, I wanted to say quickly, on December 7th, we're going to have a meeting on council. The Planning Commission is going to be there. Planning Commission intersects with this commission. I think it's very important that you're there. And on December 7th, we'll have the second reading for the 52 homes on Mountain. So mark your calendars also for maybe save that date for November 17th or 18th. I was talking to Rich, and Rich had this great idea. And so I went forward to it. It was your great idea, Rich. And so I made a phone call. And we are going to see if we can have a sneak preview of Snowberry, and we can have a tour. 90 units. People are moving in January. It'll be Adroit, a developer, Jackson County Housing Authority, you and me, and we'll all be there, and we could tour, ask some questions. More too shall come. Thank you.
And that's November 16th.
We're looking at November 17th and 18th. I did have November 9th on there, but I emailed that to you, Rich. I'm going to pull the 9th off because it looks like we'll be busy doing other things on the 9th. So mark your calendar, save the date, and more too will come. I'll send it to Linda, and Rich will take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina. You're awesome. Chris, do you have a report, SOU program report? Awesome. Linda? What else from you?
I just had an update about what we're calling the pallet shelter community. I was out there last week. Everything is actually completely ready to go. They're ready to open, except they still need 3 employees. So that has been their main hindrance. The electricians were out for 6 weeks, but they are 2 weeks away now from getting the electricity not run to the pallet shelters, but told what needs to happen to get them run to the pallet shelters. And they are still working to get people hired, but that is their biggest barrier. And some of you may have seen that they actually did an outreach for volunteers in order to just get it open as quickly as possible. So that's where we're at. That's all the news I have. Joy?
No. No heat?
There is not heat there at the pallet shelters, but they are utilizing the indoor space so people can go indoors as well to the church building.
Okay, just temporarily, not sleeping.
You know, they can. So it can serve as a shelter for up to 49 people, because that's what it did before. Theoretically, the reason that we had the pallets was so that we could have separation for people, especially health impaired people. So I suppose it would probably be up to them whether they wanted to stay inside or outside if they preferred.
Okay. Heat, yeah.
Depending on the weather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will there be electricity in those pallet shelters?
Yeah.
So that those little heating units can operate in them?
And air conditioning, I mean, and
power,
yeah.
No, it's just gonna take longer to get that functioning.
Because like everything else, all the electricians are booked out with, you know, rebuilding fire victim homes, which I totally understand. But then again, it's like, can we have an electrician, please? There's a broken window in that church too that they can't get fixed for 6 weeks because there's no window people. Yeah. Anyway, that's my update.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Thank you, everybody. We did have a report from Chad from Rogue Retreat scheduled for this meeting, and I think we're moving it to our next meeting if we can get that, if we can squeeze that into the agenda, because we'd like to get a report from the progress that they've made. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Boy, what a chock full meeting with lots and lots and lots of stuff. Thank you, especially to the subcommittee for all the work that you've done between meetings. And Linda, if you would be willing to just send out the now 12 events in November that we might want to be paying attention to, that would be great. It's going to be a busy month for commissioners. So terrific. Thank you so much. We'll see you many times next month.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you all.